Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The lunatic is in the hall. The lunatics are in my hall. The paper holds their folded faces to the floor. And every day, the paper boy brings more.
This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer. Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon is one of rock's most successful and omnipresent albums ever made, but it wasn't just some abstract exercise in writing songs about lunacy. It actually hit much closer to home for the members of Pink Floyd, who had watched as their lead singer, songwriter, and guitarist Syd Barrett descended into a drug-fueled madness of his own. The Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett Story is the title of a new DVD by English producer and director John Edginton, who joins me to look at one of rock's strangest tragic stories. John, welcome to Soundcheck today.
Thanks very much.
Now, rock certainly has no lack of tragedies. Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Nick Drake, as we've heard earlier in the program.
Yeah.
This is a tragedy of a very different sort because Barrett actually outlived the tragedy that stilled his voice, ironically, in the same year as Nick Drake's.
Yep, and he's still alive, and I'm not even sure that he would consider it a tragedy himself.
Well, let's set up for people who Syd Barrett was, because even Pink Floyd fans, many of them, don't know that there was this guy who started the band and set it on course before they hit it big.
Sure. Okay, Syd was a founder member of Pink Floyd with Roger Waters. They were both students together in Cambridge and then in London in the mid-60s, playing around with different bands, finally coming together in 65 with a lineup that included the other members of Pink Floyd that we know today. And Syd's contribution at that stage was absolutely formative. I mean, he wrote the songs. It was really his kind of inspiration that developed the Pink Floyd sound, which was a kind of psychedelic free-form sound of the mid-60s.
Strangely, though, based on American blues, apparently. I mean, Pink Floyd, he gave the band its name, and it was two sort of obscure Georgia bluesmen.
That's right. But they would kick around blues records and obviously, the kind of classic American blues artists of the time were very influential in most British pop groups emerging at that time. The Stones was another one. But what Syd did very quickly was to kind of move on from that into something which, in the first stages, if you listen to really early Pink Floyd, where they were playing in very freely, there's a CD which collectors can find, where they're just playing for about 25 minutes in the studio. And it's very free-form, very jazzy. You wouldn't really call it rock, and it's certainly not blues.
Yeah.
So he's kind of steering them in an interesting direction, but they're not quite sure where they're going in mid-60s.
And then he started writing these songs, some of which, paradoxically, were, you know, as crazy as any kind of free-form improv. And yet they became, a couple of them at least, hits in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
So now what did that do, I mean, for the band, but also what did that do to Syd Barrett?
I think there were two things happening. One was the band, when they went out and played in the country, and they did in the initial stages, 66, 67, they were almost continuously on the road. They had no money. They had a manager who saw essentially the only way to get them known was to get them out there. Continuously playing. I mean, there was one classic day when they played in Amsterdam. Then they came back from Amsterdam and played at midnight in London at a big rave. You know, Syd was becoming locked into this. At the same time, there was a pressure to produce hit records. That's what people thought pop stars did. You know, you produced a three-minute record and you went on top of the pops in the UK. So the first hit record was a song called Arnold Lane, which was, when you listen to it, it's a very strange song, a very eccentric and also very English. It's about a guy who steals women's underwear from the back gardens of Cambridge, apparently based on a character who did exist.
Mm-hmm.
And
wasn't this banned for a while, and it sort of became a hit anyway?
Well, it became kind of notorious, which always helps, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
And they had what I would consider one of the first seminal kind of pop videos, although it was shot on film, which is a black and white sequence, Pink Floyd on the beach at Brighton with a whole series of weird props, you know, dismembered heads and strange masks and so on. Brilliantly filmed in about 2 hours on the beach and turns into this great little 3-minute video, which, you know, was almost unheard of at the time.
A little piece of psychedelia. Yeah. Let's hear a little bit of the music. Arnold Lane, this was written by Syd Barrett, the first hit for the band Pink Floyd.
Arnold Lane had a strange hobby, collecting clothes, moonshine, washing line. They suit him.
Some of Arnold Lane, an unexpected hit for a young Syd Barrett, and really a formative moment in the career of the band that he formed called Pink Floyd, in which he would eventually drop out of. We're speaking with John Edginton, who is the producer and director of the video, the DVD, called The Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett Story. Almost as soon as you start talking about Syd Barrett, you have to talk, John, not just about the music, but the drugs. And
right.
On the DVD, you actually have what looks like home footage of his first acid trip. Is
yes.
that right?
Yes.
Where did you find that? I mean, it almost has kind of a Spinal Tap quality to it. He's sitting there looking at his hands.
That's right. And at one point, I think he's lying on the ground with sliced cucumber on his eyes. And it's, believe it or not, this was filmed by a filmmaker friend, and he marketed it under the title Syd's First Trip, much to the annoyance of a number of people who were his close friends, who then got it pulled from the market. It was filmed, there he is, and everyone's sort of enjoying themselves outside in the English countryside.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, there was a lot of that going around, and not everybody who was dealing in the lifestyle of sex and drugs and rock and roll succumbed to it the way Syd Barrett did. I mean, was there any indication in any of the research that you did for this project that maybe he might have been a little mentally imbalanced going into the whole thing?
I think with Syd, what happened was that he retreated into a world where the drugs kind of shut him off. And I think there was a psychological reason for that. His very good friend, Dougie Fields, who was a painter and artist that he shared an apartment with in 68 after he'd left Pink Floyd. And he was in quite a bad way. But this was a formative period as a solo writer. He started to write his solo songs. And Dougie was saying he felt that his biggest problem in a way was he'd been turned into the performing monkey by having to appear endlessly on television and so on, you know. And it went all against all his creative instincts. You know, this guy was genuinely fired and passionate about his music and about finding new ways of developing it. And I think he just found it impossible to deal with.
Mm.
So he puts up, you know, he goes into more and more into this world of drugs, and I think he probably couldn't get back.
The way you tell it, it seems like it wasn't just LSD. There was this other drug called Mandrax?
Mandrax. What
is that?
Mandrax
was,
I suppose it's fairly close to Quaaludes, but at that time it was possible to get it from a chemist, prescription from a doctor, pretty widely used. It was known as they were known as Mandis, because they were considered to be in some ways an aphrodisiac. They were known as Randy Mandis. And Sid took a lot of those. I think pretty much he tried everything, but I would say that a lot of it got pretty exaggerated. I mean, if you talk to people who actually spent time and lived with him, he was still getting up in the morning most days and leading a fairly ordered life. You know, he had a record contract. He went to the studio. He made two albums. Although he was in a very vulnerable state psychologically, he was still able to kind of say, look, I have to go and make music now, and I'm writing this song and this song and so on. You know, it wasn't all... It wasn't a complete, like, sort of disaster area at that point. And then when he finally retreated from the world, in a way, and went back to Cambridge, he had very clear reasons for it. You know, when Mick Rock, the photographer, who was a friend of his, visited him in the early 70s, you know, they have tea in the garden, and Sid says, I know, I've made a couple of albums. I'm not sure what I want to do now. I'm kind of not even sure whether I want to make music anymore. I'm interested in my painting. You know, and it's just absolute relief to be away from all the pressures. So in a sense, you know, was he necessarily that mad?
Yeah. Well, I suppose that's you can certainly point to occasions, events in his life where he did seem indeed to be, you know, on that slippery slope, that descent to madness. And one of the ones that to a man, the members of Pink Floyd recall in your DVD, is a single weekend, I guess, while he was still a member of Pink Floyd.
That's right.
Where he comes back a completely changed person.
He didn't appear to recognize me at first, sort of stared right through me. And had what Roger has very aptly put as black holes in the sky for eyes.
We were recording a Radio 1 show, and Sid didn't turn up. I think it was a Friday. And when they found Sid, which I think was a Sunday or Monday, they told us that, well, something's happened to Sid. And something had happened to him. Total difference. He took too much. Like, he'd gone. He was still looking the same, but he was somewhere else.
Now, everyone talks about his eyes.
Yes.
You know, he was this good-looking young man, this kind of, with these dark, deep-set eyes. I mean, a kind of another parallel with Nick Drake. But what happened?
Yeah, that weekend, they were booked to do a radio show, the BBC, and Sid didn't turn up. And, you know, search parties went out. Where is Sid? What's happened to him? He didn't show at all. And when he finally turned up 2 days later, I think it's Rick Wright, actually, the organist, says, you know, he's just... seems like a changed person. You know, he looked the same, but he was just changed. And the key thing seemed to be that his eyes were very deep and dark and that you couldn't see into them. There seemed to be some sort of barrier there. He was naturally a very warm, effervescent, very outgoing guy, you know, and I think that change in his eyes seemed to indicate something that had, like, almost died in him.
Yeah. We're speaking with John Edginton, who is the producer and director of The Pink Floyd and Sid Barrett Story, which is out now on DVD. This would have been 67, 68, when he was still with Pink Floyd, that this event happened, whatever it was.
Yes.
In 68, he leaves the band?
Yeah. In the mid-68, summer of 68, the Floyd go on an American tour, the first. They do a couple of TV shows, Pat Boone Show and the Dick Clark Show. Dick Clark Show went okay. Pat Boone Show said whenever Pat Boone asked him a question, apparently just stared at Pat Boone and didn't reply. Now, having seen Pat Boone myself, I can sympathize. But unfortunately, the Pat Boone Show claimed that the tapes were put in a dumpster and have been destroyed along with a lot of other tape, so we have no way of seeing this recording. But I think what's really interesting, though, I mean, for people who listen to the music, is you've got, on the one hand, this guy going through this crisis which leads to him leaving the band. On the other hand, he produces these songs which are almost, you know, giving you a kind of guided tour of his inner world, because he has a song, Jug Band Blues, for instance, where he even says questions like, you know, I wonder who's writing this song, expressing a kind of dissociation, detachment. What's the meaning of this? Is this a dream? Is it a joke? It's very kind of moving in a way as well. It's very clear, kind of lucid statements. At that point, there was a lot of pressure from Pink Floyd to produce the third hit record. They'd had Arnold Lane, they'd had See Emily Play. Now, Sid comes along with a record called, a song called Vegetable Man.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's...
Which I have to say also reminded me of Spinal Tap, watching this.
It's a song too far. I think his manager was saying, you know, he actually wrote the song when he was sitting in his room and in the manager's office, and he's literally describing what he looked like. And he's, you know, I'm wearing yellow shoes and I look terrible in my paisley shirt, I think was one line, something like that. And then there's a kind of cry for help at the end. He's like, I don't know where I, is there anywhere I can go? I don't know, have anywhere to go now. So he's going through this stage of leaving and cracking, but he's getting it down as well. And obviously Pink Floyd are very confused. Do they use this stuff? Do they take him off? You know, where are we going?
Mm. John Edginton is my guest on Soundcheck, the producer and director of the DVD The Pink Floyd and Sid Barrett Story. At some point, the band just had to leave him behind. I mean, they went on tour and didn't tell him.
Yes.
Dave Gilmour comes in, his old childhood friend, to take his place as the guitarist.
And,
and the rest, as they say, is history. I mean, Pink Floyd goes on to huge success.
Sort of mega stardom.
And he records two albums of solo material. It seems extraordinarily difficult in the making of these records because he was so kind of imbalanced at the time.
Yeah.
And yet, to listen to the songs, it goes back to what you were saying before. Somehow he was getting it done.
Yes.
A song like Dominoes is a charming little bit of very English sounding.
Yes, absolutely.
And this is from the second of his two solo records.
Right, from Barrett, isn't it?
From Barrett.
Yeah.
And this would be his last completed recording.
That's right.
And what year are we talking about?
Talking about 71.
Wow.
The last. Madcap Laughs came out 69, I believe, which was the first one. And David Gilmour produced both and helped him, steered him through both. I think David Gilmour was probably feeling elements of guilt. He replaced his childhood friend, you know, very, very close friends when they were teenagers. You know, they hitchhiked around the south of France together. You know, they had some very formative times together. Gilmour, I mean, everyone knows, is a great guitarist. I mean, he said to me he thought Sid was actually a better guitarist than he is, which is quite something.
And one would have to sift through things to find some evidence of that. But
yeah. I think in those very, very early sessions, it's there.
Well, let's hear what he did with this song called Dominoes. This is from the second and last complete record made by Sid Barrett.
It's an idea someday. It might is my dreams. Don't you want to see her prove life that comes of no harm? You and I, you and I, and dominoes, they go by. You and I in place, wasting time. A day so dark, so warm, life that comes of no harm.
We'll have more with John Edginton in just a moment. You're listening to Soundcheck.
I know a mouse and he hasn't got a house. I don't know why I call him Gerald. He's getting rather old, but he's a good mouse. You're the kind of girl that fits in with my
overheard a lark today, losing when my mind's astray. Don't you want to know with your pretty hair? Stretch out your hand.
Sid Barrett, recorded in 1971. The song is Dominoes. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. John Edginton is the producer and director of The Pink Floyd and Sid Barrett Story, which is out on DVD. And, John, it features actually Robin Hitchcock doing a version of this song.
That's right.
Which you recorded in his backyard, apparently.
Yep, in his little garden in London.
Mm-hmm. So is that part of the reason for doing this whole story about Sid Barrett, the fact that all these years later, despite the fact that the man did not produce a note of music after 73 or 74, that he still has this influence over people?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The reason really to make the film was that to celebrate, really, what he produced in such a short time, and that he is a huge influence. It's amazing how many people you kind of tap and say, mention Sid Barrett, of all ages, mm-hmm. which is why we had, you know, Robin Hitchcock, who's in his early 50s now, and Graham Coxon from Blur, who's in his 20s, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, these guys are complete Barrett fanatics. And believe me, people are Barrett fanatics. They're not, they don't just, oh, quite like him.
Right.
They are complete fanatics, you know. Mention his name and people will fall on the floor with ecstasy. This is a guy that people follow with such passion. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it's kind of an attempt to find out why, I think. That's part of the joy of doing the film.
Well, you know, if you look at people like, you know, Nick Drake or Jimi Hendrix or any of the people whose tragedies ended with their death, those people are preserved in aspic, as Patrick Humphreys, Nick Drake's biographer, puts it. Sid Barrett is in this weird kind of netherworld. I mean, I guess people do have this sort of preserved image of him as this dark, brooding, intense, good-looking young man who created this incredible music 40 years ago.
Yes, yes. I think people have lost sight of the fact that he's a living guy. He retreated from the world. He's turned his back on his legacy in a way, and he certainly hasn't wanted to be contacted or bothered about it at all. He's wanted to think about other things. Mm-hmm. I think one should respect that, actually. I mean, there's a degree to which some of those fanatical fans will try and track him down, and there's been paparazzi snooping around his dustbins and so on. You know, and I think that's just unfortunate, really.
Well, now the story that's told in the film about the sessions where Pink Floyd come into the studio to record "Shine On, You Crazy Diamond," a song about Sid, about, you know, his psychological state, and, you know, that the sort of the stopping of that flow of
absolutely
creativity,
absolutely,
is a really heartbreaking story. I mean, just sketch that for us.
Yeah, I mean that it's so heartbreaking because the song is a cry of anguish about him, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know,
on the part of the bandmates who feel they've left him behind, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, nobody knows where you are, how near or so far, you know. And then somebody looks around whilst they're recording this and sees this very large, bald-headed figure sitting in a corner with a plastic carrier bag, munching sweets.
One thing that really stands out in my, and I'll never forget, is going in to do the Shine On sessions. I went in the studio and I saw this guy sitting at the back of the studio. He's only as far away as you are from me. Well, I didn't recognize him. I said, "Who's that guy behind you?" "That's Sid." He'd shaven all his hair off. He was about probably 17, 18 stone. I mean, his eyebrows, everything. 7 years of no contact, and then to walk in while we're actually doing that particular track. I don't know, coincidence, karma, fate, who knows, but it was very, very, very powerful.
And he stays around for a while. He listens to the track. I think at one point he'd suggested he might dub some guitar music, and I think maybe everyone would have just hung on for dear life for that, but he didn't do it. And the last he was seen is sort of wandering across the road with his plastic bag, and off he went.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the last time they all saw him. Yeah.
And he walked back to Cambridge from London.
Yes. This is something that his sister told me. This would have been 1978, I believe.
So a few years after the Shine On sessions.
So he lived in London. He lived in a small flat, a small apartment. Essentially, he ran out of money. Apparently, he handed his TV set to the caretaker of the building and said, take this, I don't need it anymore. Handed his some suitcases of clothes to somebody who came and cleaned and left the building and walked back to Cambridge. So, and arrived and knocked on his sister's door and said, here I am, take me in. And he's been there ever since.
The song Shine On, You Crazy Diamond was written by Pink Floyd and obviously written as part of their ongoing working through of their own feelings about Syd Barrett. Here's a little bit of it on Soundcheck.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
Shine On, You Crazy Diamond. Pink Floyd recorded this song, actually, as it turns out, John Edginton, in the presence of the man who inspired it, their former leader and singer, Syd Barrett. John Edginton's DVD, the Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett Story, is now out here in this country. I mentioned at the beginning of our segment Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, sort of the beginning of a process of almost musical therapy for the members of Pink Floyd in the wake of Syd Barrett's departure. It continued with, you know, Wish You Were Here, Shine On You Crazy Diamond, and sort of hit, you know, fever pitch in the ambitious project called The Wall.
Sure, absolutely. The Wall is Sid's story, writ large, with Bob Geldof playing Sid, and some absolutely classic scenes from his life in there. Amazing.
Right. But when you come right down to it, I think the song that kind of sums up the feelings that you elicited from the members of Pink Floyd about Syd Barrett is the simplest song, perhaps, that they've ever written, and that is Wish You Were Here.
Sure.
So that's how we'll leave it. John Edginton, congratulations on the release finally in this country of the Pink Floyd and Syd Barrett Story, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
So you think you could tell heaven from hell, blue skies from pain? Can you tell a green field from a cold steel rail, a smile from a veil? Do you think you can tell?
Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here, a song written for or written to their founding singer and guitarist Syd Barrett. Barrett still lives in Cambridge in England, although he's in failing health. He suffers from diabetes and apparently recently lost several fingers to that disease, so he can no longer play the guitar, has trouble painting, And that is the way the story ends for the moment, the tale of Syd Barrett. And we've also been speaking about Nick Drake, two figures from the early rock scene in the UK in the early 1970s, late 1960s. And that'll do it for Soundcheck today. Our program is produced by Allison Lichter, Brian Wise, and Mike Vuolo. Our technical director is Irene Trudell. Elena Park's our executive producer. I'm John Schaefer. Hope you've enjoyed the program, and be with us again tomorrow at 2 o'clock for the next Soundcheck. Wish you were here.